Hello, my name's John Dennis. It's Friday, October the 17th. Today, Britain sets itself an ambitious new target to cut greenhouse gas emissions. But can it be done?
It's basically fantastically easy for the government to say, well, let's have 80% targets in 2050, which is so far away that they know perfectly well that they're not going to be around.
If the polls remain unchanged, Barack Obama will beat John McCain in next month's election and become the next American president. But what would the result be if the rest of the world was allowed to have a vote?
If you're a McCain supporter, there wouldn't be too much in this to delight you. He's not really popular anywhere. Obama is extremely popular.
And we'll meet a man with a very large instrument, the contrabass ophicleide.
It's like patting your head, rubbing your stomach, whilst riding a unicycle through a mud bath.
But first, the news headlines and a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
After the American markets ended with a 4.5% rise at the end of trading, the Asian markets have calmed. The Japanese market went up while others moved downwards slightly. Traders warn markets will remain mobile as businesses have had to sell stocks to raise cash rather than go to banks. The head of the financial services agency, Lauderdale Turner, says he will recruit new staff to take a tougher line regulating the city. In interviews with The Guardian and The Financial Times, he says there's no doubt the touch will be heavy. The agency is recruiting new staff to stiffen the regulation of banks and ask tougher questions about the health of financial institutions. The Trade Union for Probation Officers says bankers who sparked the credit crunch should be given anti-social behaviour orders, ASBOs as they're known. The Deputy General Secretary of the Union, Harry Fletcher, suggests speculators who acted irresponsibly could be banned from working because they've caused alarm and distress. Switzerland is the latest European country to bail out its banks. The government paying more than £25 billion to its biggest bank, UBS, to buy back bad investments, mostly in the American mortgage market. The country's other largest institution, Credit Suisse, will raise new funds on the open market. As the European summit ended in Brussels, leaders have pledged they will stick to their plans to cut gas emissions in spite of the financial turmoil. There are still many disagreements, but they agreed that they would decide the final details in December. We'll have a full story later in Guardian Daily on Britain's green commitments. In the morning papers, the economy still dominates. The Guardian and The Telegraph lead with their interviews with Lord Turner of the FSA. The FT also reports that two more small European countries, Hungary and Ukraine, are in danger of following Iceland into bankruptcy and are appealing for support from international institutions. The Times focuses on Gordon Brown's order to petrol companies to bring prices down. It also says he warned the oil-producing countries not to cut the production of oil. It's reported OPEC is organising an emergency meeting. The Express hopes that home fuel bills, gas and electricity will also come down. Energy Minister Mike O'Brien's told suppliers to move as soon as possible. The Telegraph goes out on its own to suggest interest rates may also have to come down as far as 1% to stave off a slump. On the back pages, the excitement's all about Emil Heskey. The striker, who's become a new star in his England shirt, will be available at the end of the season to move from his present club, Wigan. Several reporters believe he may go back to Liverpool. Heskey cops a return, says the Mirror, and come and get me, Rafa, headlines the Sun. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
The government has made a dramatic pledge to cut carbon emissions by 80% by the year 2050. The UK is the first country in the world to make such a commitment. The new Climate Change Secretary, Ed Miliband, has set a new goal to replace the former target of 60%. Green campaigners are delighted. Mr. Miliband also said that the government would crack down on big energy companies who overcharged customers for fuel. I asked John Vidal, The Guardian's environment editor, why Miliband has raised the government's game.
Politics is all politics. It's basically fantastically easy for the government to say, well, let's have 80% targets in 2050, which is so far away that they know perfectly well that they're not going to be around and few of us will be. Having said that, it is a very, very important international signal because it's the most ambitious in the world and it basically says Britain is serious. And no one's going to take these world climate change talks seriously unless the rich countries, led by people like Britain, are seen to be are putting in very, very strong commitments to future change. So that is extraordinarily good news. It was kind of, it's been a 5-year long, long haul by a lot of environment groups and others, they've won. In a way, you know, it's the numbers game. It doesn't really mean very much. But having said that, in international terms, it is important.
What will we have to do in order to meet this target?
To meet this target, it's so unbelievably advanced that it's horrendous to think what will have to happen. in the last 10 years, we have not managed to reduce our emissions at all, effectively. In fact, they're still going up. So we have to reduce them by more than half. I mean, this is really very, very difficult. It effectively means you have to have a different low-carbon economy within 35, 40 years. And for that to happen, it's got to start happening very quickly, because the later you leave it, the longer you leave it, the harder it is to get there. So if this government is really serious, it means it has to hit renewable targets, it has to hit energy savings targets. It's really got to go for it now. I mean, they're committed.
What effect will the coming economic recession have on these efforts to reduce emissions?
Well, we were just talking about that today. Ironically, if it were a global recession, let's hope it isn't, but if it were a global recession, then global emissions will go down. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, emissions are tied to industrial output and to people driving cars and ships and planes and boats. If they stop because consumerism takes a back seat for a while, then, of course, it will look much, much better. And there is a danger that people will say, oh, well, the emissions are reducing, when in fact it's only the recession which is talking, and as soon as the recession picks up again, or the economies pick up again, then it actually will get worse. So this is actually what the environment groups are saying. This is a fantastic time to start rethinking the whole thing.
Meanwhile, in Brussels, John, this week, European leaders reached agreement on Gordon Brown's fantastic plan to bail out the banks. They didn't find it quite so easy to reach agreement on climate change.
That's much more nitty-gritty stuff. Well, what you've had there is this real rollercoaster ride where, over the last few weeks, we've all been reporting on how Britain and other countries have been trying to undermine the European agreements on climate change for its renewable energies and things like that. And it came to a climax with Poland and Italy trying desperately to undermine the whole thing publicly, and they failed. And EU leaders have basically said, no, we are committed to this package. What that's going to mean is three enormous, great, effectively, bills coming out, which are going to determine how industry works, how consumers work, and things like that. Very, very ambitious stuff. Now, that's all going to go forward now on Monday when the environment ministers meet, and they will get down to the nitty-gritty of the whole thing. So that's going to be the real hard graft happens then. The idea is that by December, the first week in December, the Parliament and the Commission have agreed, and the EU has a final package which will involve reductions of 50% emissions by 2020, which is quite ambitious, not as ambitious as Britain alone, and they will take that to the World Climate Talks, which are taking place in Poland the following week. So it's still on target, they're still hanging in there, there's lots of opposition, but so far the line is holding.
John Vidal. And there's full coverage of the government's new climate change targets at guardian.co.uk/environment. Also on The Guardian's website today, Simon Jenkins goes in search of some good news. If you've got any, you can share it with him at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. John Henley reports from Iceland on what the country's financial collapse means for the people living there at guardian.co.uk/G2. And the Reverend Al Green, soul singer extraordinaire, is interviewed by Laura Barton at guardian.co.uk/music. If you had a vote in the American elections, who would you vote for? That question was among those put to voters living in countries other than the United States for a special international poll in which The Guardian and its pollsters ICM have taken part. No prizes for guessing which candidate is the most popular among non-Americans, but our chief leader writer Julian Glover has details of the poll.
We work together with 8 papers around the world, including Le Monde in France and La Presse in Canada, papers from America's neighbours and lots of its key allies around the world.
And surprise, surprise, the rest of the world wants Barack Obama to win.
Yes, if you're a McCain supporter, there wouldn't be too much in this to delight you. He's not really popular anywhere. Obama is extremely popular. And I think what that reflects is partly interest in Obama himself, but also a very strong resentment of what America's done over the last decade. And I hope America's going to be different under a new president.
Do the people surveyed by these newspapers around the world see their country's relationship with America as friendly?
They're a bit equivocal about America. You'd imagine that the two next door big states, Canada and Mexico, Japan, country America fought to liberate in the Second World War, places like that really would see America as their friend. Maybe France, we would expect to be a bit more sceptical. There's been a bit of a bust-up between France and America over the last few years over Iraq. But actually what happens is nowhere does a majority of the population say America's their friend. Britain's the closest. I think 49% of Britain think America is a friendly country. Most people say relations are either neutral, they're quite standoffish, or in some places there's a reasonable number of people who are hostile.
The Guardian took part in a similar exercise back in 2004 when the Democratic candidate was John Kerry. How does the enthusiasm for Barack Obama 2008 compare with Kerry 2004?
It seems to be stronger. And I think resentment of Bush is probably also stronger. In Britain in 2004, about half of the people said they'd like Kerry to be president. I guess they really just meant they didn't want Bush to be president. They probably didn't know too much about Kerry. That's risen quite substantially. And in some places, it's really up into the 70s. Sort of three quarters of the population in France, I think, wants Bush to go and be replaced by Obama. So the enthusiasm has grown. And there's a few places where it's lower. Poland, it's a lot lower. We can speculate maybe Poland doesn't like the idea of a president being too left-wing. Poland's quite right-wing politics. But generally, much stronger enthusiasm than we've ever had before.
Do Americans care very much what the rest of the world thinks about their presidential election?
Well, there's nothing in the poll today to test that, because we didn't poll in America. We know, of course, that when Obama did his global tour and he had that huge rally in Berlin, all those people he spoke to, a lot of voters in America said, hang on, what's this guy doing outside America? And he said to be quite careful since then not to look like he's a global hero. So whether this poll helps him, I don't know. But it's certainly quite telling. I think now the American public and the public around the world share a view that they want Obama to be the president.
And we don't know the answer to this really, Julian, but I mean, if Barack Obama does win the presidential election, do you think things will be as different as perhaps some of the people polled by these newspapers might hope?
Well, we'll see what happens. It's certainly true that a lot of the enthusiasm for Obama and the worry about America, because one of the questions we also asked was, has your image of America gone down in the last decade or has it risen? And people all said it had gone down. That's really the strongest result in the survey. Maybe they're just anti-American. They won't like Obama any more than they like anyone else. They resent a big, wealthy country. They resent the sort of Starbucks coffee and McDonald's culture that's spread around the world. Maybe it's not so much about people, and Obama's just the embodiment of that resentment and the hope for change. Whether they get it, we'll have to wait and see.
Julian Glover. My name's John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, a rare chance to hear an unusual musical instrument. But first, mothers who delay parenthood in order to gain qualifications and a career give children a better start in life. That's according to the latest report from the Millennium Cohort Study, which tracks the progress of the same 15,000 families whose first child was born at the turn of the century. Professor Heather Joshi is the study's director at the University of London's Institute of Education, and she says only this form of longitudinal study can provide an accurate, detailed picture of family life in Britain.
Well, I don't think we had anything in general, a good picture of what our multi-ethnic new generation looks like, because it just hadn't been documented to this extent. It certainly hadn't been documented that children from ethnic minority groups who were particularly behind educationally at the age of three are catching up when they approach school age. It hadn't been documented before that half the lone mothers who became couple families had set up house with the child's own natural father. This is the kind of information you can only get by following the child from time to time through its life.
There were significant differences in the way parenting was carried out between older and younger mothers. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, it's probably not because the younger mothers are young in themselves, but that they tend to have a less advantaged social background and less education themselves. So the older, more educated mothers and their partners report spending more time on home learning activities, reading to the child, singing with the child, than the younger parents.
What proportion of children live in traditional family groups, you know, with a married mother and father by the time they enter school age?
It's about two-thirds are living with both their natural parents married to each other.
And what difference does that make to their well-being?
Probably not much directly, but the children living with lone parents, they tend to be these younger mothers who started family formation from a disadvantaged background, and they are not well set up to enjoy the prosperity that many of the couple parents are enjoying.
What could you tell us about the way parents discipline their children?
About half of the families admitted that they occasionally smacked their child, or about half of them said they never smacked their child. And there are small social differences within this, but they're not very great, that the more educated mothers were slightly more likely to say that they never smacked their child than the younger, less educated mothers.
Do parents feel that they're spending enough time with their children?
On the whole, they say they are. Mothers with full-time jobs and fathers with full-time jobs are the least likely to say that they're spending enough time with their children. Some of the parents who haven't got jobs say they're spending too much time with their children.
What conclusions did you come to about things that the government might do to improve the lot of children?
Well, obviously the lone parent families, especially the younger uneducated mothers, the children are very much at risk as well as their mothers, and that a battery of supports in terms of education opportunities for the mother as well as the child would seem to be useful to target on these families.
Well, what do you think is the most important conclusion of this study?
The 5-year-olds of 2006, who will be the citizens of the future, are on the whole doing quite well, but there are some who are lagging behind, and there are social disadvantages and ethnic disadvantages quite apparent in this very large body of data. The measurement that we've got that's most sensitive of what we've measured is their cognitive attainment, doing tests on their vocabulary and other kinds of non-verbal tests of their learning. That varies most with social background. Their health also shows a social pattern, but the inequalities in health are not as great as the inequalities in learning.
Professor Heather Joshi from the University of London's Institute of Education. That's the sound of a 6-foot-tall musical instrument called the contrabass ophicleide, being played there by Anthony George. Tomorrow night, Anthony will be playing the ophicleide with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, which specialises in playing old instruments, at London's Royal Festival Hall. He told The Guardian's arts correspondent, Mark Brown, about the instrument's history.
I'm Tony George, and I'm the ophicleidist with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. In front of me is the only playable contrabass ophicleide in the world.
That's incredible. There's only one in the world.
No, there are more in the world, but there's only one that's playable. There are three in museums, and they're not as good. They've got holes in, they're 150 years old. This one was made in California by a guy called Rob Stewart, who is a brass instrument maker to all the session guys in Los Angeles. He made this in the 1960s. There were originally two of them that he made, but the other one unfortunately got wrecked in a car crash. So this is the only one left in the world that works really well.
And when would they have been played? They would have been played presumably in the 19th century.
Absolutely. The Birmingham Festival which is what we're all about here. The Mendelssohn's Elijah was written for the Birmingham Festival in 1846, commissioned in 1833 a contrabass offa clef for a French player called Prosper to play. I think that was back in the days when size was everything and every festival had to have a bigger and better choir and a bigger and better orchestra and a bigger and better organ. So the contrabass was the biggest thing they could find. And so that's what we're doing. We're recreating Mendelssohn's very first performance.
And they kind of went out of fashion, did they? Or why don't we see them anymore?
Well, mostly it's ease of use. I mean, if you look at... It's difficult to see this, on, obviously, on an audio clip. But it's got 11 keys. And I don't know about you, but I've only got 10 fingers. So it's quite difficult to play. Whereas a modern tuba has four, maybe five vowels. So it's much easier to play.
And how would you describe the sound of it? Because I read somewhere that somebody described it as sounding like a bullock.
Oh, that was George Bernard Shaw. He called it, his nickname for it was the chromatic bullock. But that was towards the end of the 19th century, and he should have known better. I think the great thing about these instruments is they make a unique sound. It's nothing like today's instruments, and it gives us an insight into the sound world that the composers really heard in their heads.
Is it easy to play?
No, it's a complete pig. I mean, it's like patting your head, rubbing your stomach, whilst riding a unicycle through a mud bath.
That easy?
That easy.
Mark Brown reporting. Roxanne Escobales and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.